Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and librarians about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. Today I'm delighted to be talking with Nancy Bezea, professor of history at Vassar College and author of the book Creating East and West, Renaissance Humanists and the Ottoman Turks, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Welcome, Nancy.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, Tom.
Your book is about the way history and the events of the past still drives the way we look at events in the world today. And several weeks ago, we were talking with Jeffrey Bowker, an historian of science and scientific culture, about the nature of historical memory. And he made the point that the concepts we use to organize the past often have as much or more to do with forgetting as they do with remembering. And the geographic classifiers that your book investigates, East and West, seem to me to perform this kind of work in that in one fell swoop they reduce a very complex set of relationships, both historically speaking, but also for our own time, between cultures, nations, and peoples, to a kind of spatial binary that doesn't in itself really tell us much. So before we go on to talk about the history of these terms, can you say whether they still have any real usefulness anymore, except as historical artifacts, and should we be trying to move away from them?
Well, that's an excellent question, and there's no quick and easy answer for that. What do you do with the terms East and West in the present? I'm certainly more comfortable discussing them in a past tense, and find it easier when I'm talking to a class or to a group of other scholars about the notions that people used in the past. The question as to how useful they are in the present, I think that whether we like it or not, the terms aren't going to go away. Mm-hmm. And I think that people are going to continue using them. And the best that we can hope for and what we should strive to do is to encourage a thoughtful approach to that. You know, maybe perhaps sometime in the future people will do away with these terms and try to be much more specific when they're talking about a certain idea or practice and try to speak specifically to, you know, what country or city or culture or, you know, time period or class are you looking at. And, you know, obviously I think for a lot of terms there's huge crossover between these areas that we narrowly define East and West. Mm-hmm. You know, it is a reductive term. So to answer that, I guess I would say that the terms keep coming up. I think people do it sometimes not necessarily to be culturally reductive, but as a form of shorthand. Yeah. You know, it does get to be laborious after a while to keep saying, well, in Germany and Italy and France and, you know, to a lesser extent in Norway and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's much easier to say this Western concept.
Yeah.
So, you know, as much as we can encourage people to break down those concepts as they talk about them and to be specific, I think that's what we have to try to do rather than try to eradicate them from the language.
This may seem an odd question to ask a historian, but what about history itself as a cultural memory practice? And that sometimes it feels from a modernist perspective, particularly, that we carry with us from the past a lot of baggage that sometimes seems to keep us from moving forward. And I'm thinking of the present tensions in Bosnia and Serbia being a case in point. So are there right ways and wrong ways of remembering the past?
Another good question. You know, it's a difficult question to pin down because I think that sometimes people with the best intentions when they want to talk about the past sometimes do it a disservice by oversimplifying it and making it look like people got along better than they did, or that, you know, certain empires were benign and beneficent and treated everybody well. And, you know, I think sometimes what I notice in my work, even though I criticize many Western cultural viewpoints, I think that there's a knee-jerk tendency for people to look back on Western practices and to just want to criticize them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that really gets us any closer to an understanding of things that took place in the past or things that are happening in the present.
Yeah.
You know, I think that we have to look at all societies that we study in the past and in the present with a very critical eye and not be afraid to talk about times when societies were not getting along, even if it seems like it's politically incorrect.
Yeah.
You know, the more that we talk about the uncomfortable realities, I think the better understanding we'll have about why people have a certain response that they do. I mean, I'll try to give you an example. I'm talking very vague terms here. I visited Turkey and Greece a couple years ago, and I mean, there's an area where you have very rich and contested view of the past. When you just cross over the Aegean Sea, when you hear Turks and Greeks talking about the Byzantine past or the Ottoman past, and, you know, and there, that's a huge generalization, right? I mean, obviously not all Turks are going to see it the same way, not all Greeks are going to. But I think the more that people can try to talk about the past in a dispassionate and honest way, the better. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the oversimplifications are what lead to a lot of the hostilities, like you mentioned with Bosnia and Serbia. You know, that's one of the worst abuses of the past.
So can history serve as a kind of therapy, do you think, like a talk therapy almost?
You know, I think in some ways, perhaps, because I think one of the worst abuses of history is when one group of people want to either portray themselves as victims or another group as the perpetrators. Mm-hmm. And when you oversimplify it in those terms, it seems like there's no hope for progress, right? That it's always going to be this group that's oppressing the other group. And, you know, that's why I think a lot of scholars rightly look for empowerment in groups that used to be categorized as victims. Yeah. And they rightly try to look at examples of, you know, imperialist ideologies and start to deconstruct them and say, you know, were they as oppressive as we might think in all cases? You know, where is the give and take there?
Yeah, the government of France recently was pushing to have its colonial presence in North Africa revised. Supposedly the textbooks were supposed to show the benefits of French colonial rule in North Africa. Mm-hmm. Though that was finally shot down, I think.
Really?
I think suppose he got rid of it, yeah. So.
It's a tough line to argue, and I think that what we should try to look for as historians is the role of individuals as much as possible, and just to try to complexify those groups.
Yeah. If history is a kind of therapy, and it's a therapy that has something to do with rectifying traumas, the big trauma that you talk about in your book is the fall of Constantinople, it seems, and the subsequent effect this had on the European imagination after 1453. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about that?
Sure. The reason I think it's important in an historical context is that the fall of Constantinople is one of the first events that I can think of as a scholar that got huge members of the European community writing about it in response. Mm-hmm. And it also takes place right about the time of the invention of the printing press. So it's one of the first epic changes of power, you know, the end of the Byzantine Empire or the near end of it, and not the rise of the Ottoman Empire, but certainly a turning point where it goes from being an empire kind of considered to be on the fringes, something that was somewhat considered to be contained, I think falsely so, but considered by a number of Europeans, to one that really had to be reckoned with as European power. So it's an important turning point because it's discussed much more broadly than many events before it, and it's intellectualized by this group of scholars, humanists, who are aware of it for two reasons. I think they are aware of it because they sense a military threat now coming toward Europe.
Yeah, and it's a real threat, isn't it?
Yeah, and it is a real threat. I mean, absolutely. The Ottoman Empire continued to conquer areas in Eastern Europe and the Mediterranean. They even attacked southern Italy and held a base in Otranto for a year in 1480 to 1481. So, I mean, they were a very clear and present danger, if you will. but so they weren't making that up. At the other side of that is, at the same time, I think they were wrestling with the concept of their own cultural identity more and more, that they were thinking about notions of what does it mean to be European, what does it mean to be Western, so to speak, what does it mean to be civilized. They were very fond of that notion, and it is, I guess, just an unfortunate coincidence that at that point in time the Ottoman Turks present themselves as a military threat, and they very nimbly, for the humanist point of view, slip into the role of barbarian aggressors. You know, so they start to play a foil for humanists in all of these notions of how they define themselves. They, most of them, like to categorize the Ottoman Turks as the opposite.
Yeah. So is this the point where medieval Christendom becomes modern Europe then, and the term Europe begins to be used?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is where you start to see it. It's certainly, the term Europe has an older heritage, but it's something actually that you don't see used very often in the classical period or in the medieval period, that it's just used in a passing sense, not in any sustained critical way, not as this large identifier. And you start to see it being used more, I think, 13th, 14th century, and especially the 15th century is where it starts to take hold. And people don't stop talking about Christendom. They don't stop using, you know, Christianitas or Res Publica Christiana, for instance. They don't stop using terms like Christian and infidel. But they begin to heavily supplement it with this idea of Europe. You know, they're looking for something that binds these other nation states together beyond Christendom. I think you know, largely because the papacy is becoming a problematic issue. You've just the Europeans have just suffered through the schism, where you have two and three popes at one point, and it's hard to talk about all Christians uniting under a pope because they went through several decades where the papacy was split. And also, you have the idea of the Holy Roman Emperor in Germany, which was a uniting principle. I mean, always a very complicated and tendentious notion, but nonetheless, one that people could at least acknowledge in a nodding fashion as something that helped give them a sense of unity. The Holy Roman Emperor was also losing power, was also seeming like a more and more marginal figure, even in Germany alone, let alone the rest of Europe. So I think that scholars and thinkers and just many writers in general are thinking about what unites people in Britain with people in Hungary and people in Italy. If we can't use some of these terms that we used to use before, what else brings us together in some common sense?
And what comes up is this notion of Turks as barbarians, right? And does this come out of new discoveries of classical materials or?
Yeah, it does. Right, absolutely. Yeah. Where it comes from, I think one of the major shifts in outlook toward Muslim peoples from a Western point of view, from, see there, I used it Western, but you know, I'm talking the 15th century, so that's okay. But in any case, from a European point of view, is that for many centuries, it was much more common to talk about them as, you know, quote-unquote Saracens or quote-unquote Mohammedans. You know, there was another...
Yeah, there was a religious polemic.
Right, exactly, infidels, what have you. But to, to say that, you know, we are Christians and they are something other. And what starts to change in the 14th and 15th century is this rediscovery of antiquity that was never really lost in the Middle Ages, but I think begins to take on greater significance for writers. They also just have greater access to it than they used to. They begin to speak in the rhetoric of classical texts more and more. They begin to use it in the political sphere, and they become very aware of this rhetorical notion of a barbarian that they see in Greek works talking about the Persians, that they see in Roman and Greek works talking about people like the Visigoths and the Ostrogoths and the Vandals and the Huns and such, and at the end of the Roman Empire. The other thing that's going on is I think Europeans are starting to develop a more nuanced sense of historical perspective. For a long time, I think, in the Middle Ages, there wasn't necessarily a huge sense that a break had happened. All right, that I think people saw themselves more in continuity with the Roman Empire, that they were still carrying on traditions of ancient
Rome. The Middle Ages, that's very much the case. They didn't really make a distinction.
Absolutely. So I think that they, for them, they didn't necessarily think that any major shift had taken place. But when the Renaissance begins to happen as a cultural movement, Italians in particular, I think, they're very conscious of the ruins around them, and they start thinking more and more about the history, and they start to wonder, well, obviously we're not living in the Roman Empire anymore, so what happened? What brought about that shift? And they begin to think more and more about this notion, this incipient notion that a few earlier writers talked about, the fall of Rome. And that gets them thinking more and more about the role that barbarians played. So you have all these things going on in humanist rhetoric where I think this greater involvement with the classical past gets people more comfortable with the term barbarian again as a cultural other, and also thinking about the major shifts that barbarians can bring about. I teach a course on the Dark Ages, and you know, of course, we debunk this, right? Rome fell for a lot of reasons, and Rome didn't fall all at once, and the barbarians certainly were not this horde of ravaging barbarians. You know, it was a much more complex idea, but the humanists certainly wanted to see it in those terms, that you're looking at that opposition of civility and barbarism.
Interesting. And it is true that there is this horror that culture is being destroyed by the Turks, isn't there? And, you know, and there are libraries being burned, which happens whenever you have
whenever,
war.
Whenever there's warfare,
But this is particularly what's used then to define what the Turks are all about, that they're destroying culture.
That's another part of it. That's an excellent tie-in. That one of the connections that I try to make is, at the same time that they start thinking about these things in a kind of a loose fashion. For instance, you have the example of Leonardo Bruni in the 1440s, thinking about how many works from ancient Rome had been lost. He's thinking particularly about Livy's work on the history of Rome, and he has an awareness that they have only a small portion of that very large monumental work. So then he starts positing theories about what happened, you know, what happened to the rest of this work? And then he starts talking about the fall of Rome. Well, obviously, when the Goths and the Vandals came in, you know, a lot of libraries were destroyed and learning was lost. And he makes this little reference and says, just as we see in Greece with the Turks today, this idea that the Greeks were losing much of their cultural heritage and their learning, their libraries and such, and scholars were being scattered because many scholars were coming west. Mm-hmm. So I think there was this notion that the same thing was happening. What really makes that notion take hold, though, is the fall of Constantinople. And what happens in Constantinople, at least as far as we can tell from some reports, a few reports make a point of saying that when the Turkish soldiers, the Ottoman soldiers, I should say, we're talking about a mixed army, so certainly a composite army in nature, but when they storm the city, that there's some loss of property, that there's stories about the Turks, you know, in their desire to loot, because mm-hmm. that's part of what drives you into the city as a soldier, right? You're given the opportunity, you're not just paid, but you're given the opportunity to loot, and this is how soldiers all over the world would get rich at this time. So in the process of looting, a lot of libraries are emptied out, and we hear stories about books being carted off and sold for a pittance. We also hear stories about books being thrown in the harbor, libraries being torched. And whether this is true or not is hard to say. I mean, I'm sure that there was some destruction of property. I don't really think it was intentional. You know, I don't think that this was part of some sort of cultural program on anybody's part. I just think this was one of the casualties of war. In any case, though, accounts that are written at this time, especially ones that are written by Westerners taking up these reports, make a huge point of emphasizing this. And they start to argue that this is consciously done by the Turks, that they are opposed to literature, they're enemies of learning and culture, and that they can't tolerate its existence. So they take essentially the looting of a city and try to make it look like it was this intentional means of destroying another culture. So that adds to this notion of the Turks as barbarians. You know, they're not just foreign aggressors, but they are opposed to the very notions of learning that humanists at this time were trying to recover. I think that's partly why they were so horrified, is many humanists were going over to the Greek East and just starting to hunt through libraries and go to book dealers and say, wow, we didn't know this manuscript still exists. You know, can we order copies or can we buy this from you? And so they thought that the Greek East, they were just beginning to rediscover it as this storehouse for Greek learning, because they were also rediscovering Greek learning. You know, for a few centuries, they were much more focused on Latin learning. Yeah. So now with this opportunity to learn more about Greece, they perceive it as opportunities being lost.
I found it very interesting, especially, and this must be interesting to anybody living in the academic world or making a living in the academic world, that the humanist writers that you look at are mostly academics of various kinds, teachers, scholars, and sometimes chancellors. Did humanity scholars have more influence on politics back then than they seem to do now? And maybe with the exception of the neocons, whose polemics, frankly, seem to owe a lot to the anti-Ottoman discourses you talk about. I mean, Norman Potthart's just put out a book in November still championing the cause of the forces of civilization against barbaric, you know, Islamofascists. Right. It almost reads like one of the texts that you talk about. But it is interesting that these people are academics.
No, it is. It's a very interesting question. I'll try to answer that in two parts if I can. The first part about, you know, do we see a modern counterpart to humanists in the sense of their involvement in government and such?
Usually we feel ignored,
right? I mean, as I tell my classes, that, you know, when you look at Renaissance humanists, these were people who were at the forefront of political thought. They were sought out for bureaucracies as ambassadors, as advisors, as chancellors. You know, there's an office we don't really have anymore, but chancellors were kind of like public relations people and foreign relations all rolled into one. And they would write these wonderful speeches and letters to foreign rulers, trying to persuade them or to cow them in various ways regarding the policies of their state. Mm-hmm. But these were people who were trained as classicists. And the notion was that this gave you the tools to be a statesman, because everything you needed to know about statecraft and about society was embedded in these Greek and Latin texts. Mm-hmm. I think they felt a greater sense of continuity, or I should say a greater sense of resonance with Greek and Latin texts than they did with a lot of Christian political texts, because they, you know, living in Italy, we're talking about city-states, we're talking about republics, we're talking about some popular governments, and the notion that they saw looking back to the Roman Republic, to Greek democracy, that spoke to them much more than, you know, something like a mirror for princes, you know, where a good Christian prince should make all the decisions and just always do what's right, and that wasn't working for them. They wanted to see something, a sense of broader civic involvement. So, I mean, for them, it made perfect sense that they had the training. They also had the eloquence, mm-hmm. right? Because you studied Greek and Latin eloquence in order to make these wonderful speeches, which are still being done in Latin,
yeah.
to write these letters. You know, the correspondence, the records were kept in Latin until the end of the 15th century, with a few exceptions. So for them, that made a great deal of sense. I can only say I wish classicists would be sought out as members of yeah. government and, you know, and medievalists
yes.
and such. I mean, I think that we obviously have a lot to offer, but there is that widespread perception that, you know, we're not really up on current political trends and that we don't have anything to contribute. But I just think it's fascinating. It's instructive, the sense that people with a greater historical perspective were thought to be necessary for government at that time.
I found very interesting your description of the instrument of the public letter that
mm-hmm.
you were just talking about.
Right.
Reminded me a bit of the, you know, contemporary blog, possibly.
Yeah.
You know, the letter is a type mm-hmm. of private correspondence, but in this case it's used as a means mm-hmm. of publication.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the chancellors wrote their letters very consciously, I think, to be read by as many people as possible. I think that a lot of people writing at this time wrote letters in that fashion, too. You know, there's a saying that Caluccio Salutati, who was the chancellor of Florence at the end of the 14th century, that one of his letters was worth something like 100 horses or 100 horsemen in the ruler of Milan's army, you know, that he had that kind of power to persuade. So as far as the neocon connection
yeah.
goes, God, you know, I have thought about that.
Yeah, it must mm-hmm. Ring a bell sometimes.
It does ring a bell. I guess, you know, maybe this is just my own personal feelings intruding on my work, but I have much greater sympathy for the humanists than I do for the neocons, just because I think that they were operating under a much more limited set of assumptions, that the body of knowledge they had on the East was much more limited,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, they just didn't have as many sources of information at their disposal that the neocons do. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think the neocons, where they really fail is that they just look for a certain set of information that is pleasing to them and to their political views. It allows them to package these goals in a certain way. And I think that they're just not very good scholars. They're not looking at you know, a broad set of knowledge, and they don't want to hear from people who challenge them. They don't
yeah.
want to hear statistics about, you know, modernization in the Middle East taking place in a different form from what they think modernization should be. But, you know, I think that the humanists, it is a fair point, because I think to a certain extent there are some parallels, because
yeah.
I think that their concern was much more with the West
yeah.
than really understanding the East. And I think that in that sense, they are very much like the neocons, that they're not very interested in a relationship. They're
yeah.
not very interested in, you know, taking the blame for problems in that relationship.
Although yeah. some are, aren't they? I mean, there's some writers who glamorize
mm-hmm.
the Turks
right.
and see them certainly as efficient
right.
and have a high regard for them for that. But I'm thinking more of the influence of these discourses, you know, unconscious, traveling through the culture over the years
mm-hmm.
somehow and finding their way into
mm-hmm.
the thinking of people like Norman Poderz, where
mm-hmm.
he doesn't really realize that
right.
the prejudices and the axioms that he's starting out with are things that he's inherited.
Mm-hmm.
They're not reactions to actual
yeah.
events.
Right, right. No, excellent
on the ground
point.
Today.
I think that's true, and that's
yeah.
one of the things I try to bring out in the book, is the sense that I think a lot of notions that we use unconsciously of East and West are ones that are inherited going
yeah.
back to the 15th century. That, you know, this notion that, well, of course we're superior because we're Western and, you know, we stand by these principles, blah, blah, blah. You know, people don't realize that this is something that was very much a cultural invention of the 15th century, and it goes hand in hand with the notion of Western civilization. And I say that with the sense that I don't mean to be wholly critical of some of the ideas that came out of the Renaissance. I mean,
yeah.
I think a lot of good things came out of the Renaissance. The notion of the dignity of man and you know, more popular government, and, you know, begin to see arguments for the separation of church and state
mm-hmm.
and, you know, various important concepts that we still embrace today. But I think that there were a lot of negative byproducts of the Renaissance as well, and this is one of them, the sense that as they're building up their notion of how great their culture is, they are very uncritically creating this notion of an Eastern foil
mm-hmm.
and creating this false sense of opposition
yeah.
between East and West that does continue on, and many people just continue to use it without realizing that it wasn't well-grounded then. You know, it's not well-grounded now.
So do these Renaissance humanist discourses on the Turks and Islam generally influence, say, attitudes in the modern period?
Yeah, I think they do. I mean, actually, if I can go back to one point that
sure.
you made, too, about when you talk about some positive views that you
mm-hmm.
see among humanists, that's an extremely important point, because While I would say the majority of humanists, at least the time that I'm focusing on, which is the 14th and early 16th century, while the majority of these views tend to be negative and tend to sound very much alike, there are quite a few scholars who break out of that mold and try to look at the Turks in a more open-minded fashion. And I think the reason that they're able to do this as humanists, you know, why they don't all have to fall in lockstep and write and think in the same way, is that one of the interesting things that humanists taught them is perhaps a break with some of the religious notions of the Middle Ages, that as a Christian you must decry Islam, you know, that there's always going to be this sense of opposition. What humanism starts to do is create a greater sense of nuance in how people can view other cultures, not always how they do, but how they can, in the sense that maybe religion isn't the first and the last component that we need to be aware of, that you can look at a culture for its political organization, and you can say, you know, wow, they have this fantastically well-structured bureaucracy and a legal system, and, you know, and they maintain order much better than we do. They have a greater sense of unity. That's something that people like to say about the Turks, especially as they felt that Europeans had no sense of unity. So sometimes I think what humanism allowed some of these thinkers to do was to take religion out of it and therefore to look more openly at positives and negatives, but just to start to look at things, I guess you would say, in a secular way. Now, that, you know, of course, that doesn't always mean that they're going to look positively on them, but it allows for that. And it allows for, you know, a more progressive mode of looking at other cultures. So that's, I just want to mention that part. But going back to your other question about colonialism and such, where I see the connection, and this is my big critique on Said, I think a lot of Said's ideas are very useful.
It's Edward Said.
Edward Said of Orientalism. I have some criticisms on his approach. I think that he's a little too sweeping in his generalizations about Orientalist scholars and too willing to condemn and just lump all of these people in one category, I think, in an unfair fashion. But, you know, that being said, I think that his work was groundbreaking to talk about how there was this unconscious but powerful discourse of East versus West, right? And he argues that this takes shape in the colonial period because, for him, you have to have military and political power going hand in hand with this intellectual power, that it's only when the English and the French are trying to set up colonies in the East that they really start to talk in these very strident terms about the backwardness of Muslims and their need for this patriarchal society and to be brought into the future and such. So for him, then, it has to be part of this political agenda. Now, what I argue when I look back at the humanists is that they're saying very similar things, or I should say they're making some of the same criticisms about the Turk, and they start to say it about Muslims in general. You know, they begin to branch out from the Turks to all of Muslims. But in any case, when they do this, they're not writing from a position of political strength and military strength by any means. They're writing as the people who are literally under siege, under threat, and who are in a weaker position militarily and politically. So I think that that sense of the threat, that sense of insecurity, can give rise to this kind of rhetoric. You don't have to be in a position of power in order to use it. So that's, you know, one way in which I depart from him, is to say that I think he's right about a lot of these notions and how they take shape, but I don't think it has to happen within the context of a colonial power or an aggressive power. Right. I think that, you know, it's very much the opposite. So the connection between that and colonialism, as I see it, is you start to see this discourse developing in the 15th century about the Turks, about how the Turks are cultural inferiors, about how they are opposed to learning and urbanization, and, you know, trying to portray them as these very backward nomadic people, which was, you know, obviously far from the case, but trying to portray them as these stereotypical barbarians, right, in the classical sense of the word. And as they're doing that, creating a sense of what civility means, right? Now, that takes a few decades to settle in and to become a discourse. And I argue that by the time Columbus and others begin going over to the Americas and begin to make contact with the Native Americans, that what that discourse on the Turks allows them to do, it's like a ready-made discourse on civilization. That they go over there with these concepts that might have been created vis-a-vis the Turks, but it allows them to say, well, gee, these people are different from us. We must be the civilized ones, and they must be the barbarians, because we know what civility is. Yeah, so I think
that's very interesting.
Yeah, I think it's important in that way because it happens right before a lot of these colonial endeavors in Africa, or as they're taking place in Africa, in India, and in the Americas. And I think that what it allows them to do is to have a greater notion of themselves. It doesn't help them very much, unfortunately, in looking at other cultures. I think it really closes them off from looking at them in an open way. But I think it does lend itself to a justification process.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's a fairly extensive literature on medieval Christian attitudes towards Islam, which is becoming more interesting and more complex itself, especially if you take into consideration the 12th century Renaissance. And some, there's some recognition that there's some good coming out of out of contact with the East. And also, you know, with people like Said, and especially lately with post-colonial studies about modern Western colonial military and cultural chauvinism toward the East. But, you know, you point out that scholars rarely write about the Renaissance as a formative period of modern attitudes toward Islam or for cultural constructions of any kind. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was very interesting, and I wonder if you could elaborate on that. Mm-hmm.
Why they tend not to look at the Renaissance?
Yeah, is it because of the way we construct the Renaissance?
Yeah, I think for two reasons. One just goes back to what I was saying in the sense that people tend to associate those kinds of notions with colonialism. Mm-hmm. And because the period I'm looking at immediately precedes they tend to think that these cultural constructs can't be happening at that time.
But the medieval period's pre-colonial also, and we get all the blame. I'm being a medievalist myself.
People perhaps still tend to think of the Renaissance as being much more enlightened a time period, that they don't imagine that a lot of these negative cultural stereotypes and discourses are actually taking shape at this time. So, I think they just don't imagine that people have anything to say about the Turks. I also think that a lot of times people make the mistake of imagining that if you want to find the origins of stereotypes and such, you need to go to a place and a time when people are in contact. Mm-hmm. And I argue that it happens when people are sometimes in the most peripheral of contact or in no contact at all. In this case, there's obviously some contact between the Ottoman Empire and Western Europe, and there are a lot of intermediaries going back and forth. Byzantine refugees are providing a lot of information, and, you know, some of it's very accurate information, some of it is obviously very colored by their experiences, and understandably so. I mean, they're refugees. They're not happy about that. But what's important is that this doesn't stop the Renaissance humanists from thinking they're authorities on the Ottomans. You know, they're writing histories, they're writing treatises about how we have to handle the Ottoman threat, treatises on converting them, and just all of these very authoritative sounding works that people read and take as reference works at this time. So the lack of contact didn't disturb people at the time as much as we might think. And I think that a lot of the ideas, the presuppositions that start to take shape at this time when there's less contact, continues to spill over in a time when there's more contact. And I'll give you an example. I notice this when I read travelers' accounts. Mm-hmm. And here's a perfect example where I think people often think, okay, you read a traveler's account, this is someone who visits the Ottoman Empire. Surely they must think these people are great. And they do, to an extent. You read Ogier de Busbecq, you read Nicolas de Nicolet, and others, and they are impressed by what they see. But what's fascinating to me is they do frequently slip back into the stereotypes that they see from this kind of humanist literature, where they'll say things about, oh, you know, this is such a great place, too bad they're wrecking Greek culture. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's, in some ways, they're looking more openly at this culture as travelers, but I don't think the blinders are completely gone. You know, I think they still inherit a lot of these perceptions that they don't shed.
Yeah, that's interesting. Just backing up a bit, how do the Renaissance notions of barbarity and the other differ from ancient Greek and Roman attitudes?
Well, it differs. I mean, the most fundamental way in which it differs is that there's the religious element now.
Yeah.
And it's, even though you see to some extent around the time of the fall of Rome, actually a lot of the Goths were Christians. They were Arian Christians. They weren't Orthodox Christians. But still, that, even in the writers at the time, they thought that that made them less of a threat.
Yeah.
They were less concerned about them than you might imagine. But yeah, so I think that religious component really ups the animosity level in the rhetoric. It tends to sharpen it quite a bit. And I also think they're different in the sense that I think there's a perceptible sense of threat, whereas I think oftentimes when we're reading the Greek and Roman accounts, they still feel they have the upper hand. And I think that the Renaissance writers are trying to mimic that, trying to argue that, yes, we are culturally superior, but I think part of the reason they're arguing so stridently that they are culturally superior is because politically and militarily, they are feeling inferior.
Yeah.
So that's perhaps leading them to emphasize this more than Greeks and Romans did.
Interesting. So how does Petrarch figure in the discourse of East and West? I know he doesn't like the Turks, and he doesn't seem to like the Greeks either.
Right. Yeah, Petrarch's an interesting case. I think what happens at this time period I like to think of it as the Greeks and the Latins. When I say Latins, I mean Western Europeans. Yeah. So the Greeks, the Western Europeans, and the Turks as being in a triangular relationship. Sometimes the Greeks seem to gravitate more closely to the Latins, sometimes toward the Turks. And that could be in a cultural sense, that could be in a political sense. The Greeks are viewed alternately with suspicion and a sense of common cultural goals and history and common religious program, depending on the time, you know, depending on who's speaking. I think part of this just goes back to the Crusades. When the Crusaders went over to the east to help the Byzantine emperor, this was kind of a surprise for him because he was essentially looking for mercenaries, and they came as this great Christian army who were coming to liberate the Holy Land. I think, you know, something got garbled in transmission. The Pope, I think, got a little ahead of himself, preached something a little different to these soldiers who took it up as this great religious cause. And what that sets off is a history of difficult relationships between Latins and Greeks, where the Latins don't understand why the Greeks are not always completely on their side, why they are willing to make deals with Muslim polities and emirs and such, why they are much softer in their notion of dealing with them. I think they haven't yet understood the notion of having to live among Muslims as neighbors, right, as allies. And so sometimes the Greeks get classified by the Latins as being as bad as the Muslims, right? As being in league with them, as being obstacles to crusade. And then, of course, you have thrown into the mix the very important notion that they're not all under the Pope of Rome, right? You have the schism going back to 1054. And that leads to this sense that the Greeks are sometimes called heretics, certainly called schismatics, that they're somehow different and that they are resistant to a relationship with the Latins.
Yeah, and the Greeks were sometimes victims of Roman crusaders, right?
Yes.
In a big way sometimes.
Yes, the Fourth Crusade of 1204, that was a crusade that was supposed to go directly to the Holy Land, and through a series of unfortunate events, shall we say, the crusaders ended up in Constantinople, ended up besieging the city and sacking it brutally in 1204. So that certainly led to some very bad blood on the part of the Greeks and a real mistrust between themselves and the Latins. So what we start to see in the Renaissance is this very strange heritage of all of these notions that you still see a lot of holdover from the medieval period, where the Greeks are still seen as schismatics, as friends of the Muslims, as just not Western enough, whatever that means. Yeah. And at the same time, though, as the Latins are rediscovering, or I should say recreating, their attachment to the Roman past, they're also rediscovering the Greek past. Mm-hmm. And they're beginning to see the commonality that they have with ancient Greece as well as ancient Rome. I think they're becoming more aware of how friendly the ancient Romans were toward Greek culture, even though there was a lot of antagonism there too. They began to think maybe they had more in common culturally with the Greeks.
They certainly didn't regard the Greeks as barbarians.
Right, absolutely.
It was just the opposite. They started to see themselves.
Right, absolutely. And I mean, that's part of it too, is I think that the Latins oftentimes got the very real sense that the Greeks thought that they were the barbarians. Yeah. So you start seeing more Greek scholars coming west, and the study of Greek goes on the increase in the West. And so on the one hand, there's a growing fascination with Greece and a desire to reach out and create greater links. But at the same time, I think there's still this sense that they're not fully reconciled with the Church, and that they would just as soon ally with the Turks as fight against them. And so they're often caught in the middle in this very interesting way. You know, what I try to argue in my book is that in the 15th century, you still see that process. You see that ambivalence on the part of Latin scholars, where on the one hand, they are horrified when Constantinople falls. They talk about the poor Greeks and this civilization is crushed and what a terrible moment this is. But at the same time, you see these subtle comments saying, well, maybe they deserved it, right? That they brought it upon themselves. This was an act of God, that the Turks are really just carrying out God's punishment, or that the Greeks just couldn't get it together enough, that they were greedy is a common charge, that they weren't willing to spend money on their own defense, which is, really unfair, especially since, they were trying to hire people to come and few people were coming. But the notion is that, you see the humanists kind of going back and forth between sympathy and cultural attacks. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I argue in my book is that I think over time, after the fall of the Byzantine Empire, and especially as more Greeks settle in the West, once the Byzantine Empire is no longer this powerful entity, I think that attitude toward the Greeks begins to soften, mm-hmm. that they can no longer see them as any kind of opposition to crusade. They can no longer see them as this powerful kingdom who are anti-Pope in some way. That these are people who are now living among them, who pose no political obstacle whatsoever. So they begin to enter more into the Western conscious, I think, as being part of the West and not part of the East.
Interesting. So how does this play out today, then, in perceptions between East and West?
Mm-hmm. I try to make a few suggestions, and mm-hmm. I mean, I don't like to overreach this because, I'm a scholar of the Renaissance, and, a lot happens between the Renaissance and the 21st century, but I think that some of the connections that I see that I would like to see people discuss more and work on and see if there's something to it. One of the shifts that I see with the humanists is they go from just looking at the Turks as barbarians to starting to talk about all Muslims as barbarians. Mm-hmm. I talk about a few pieces where they talk about the Muslims in Egypt, the Fatimid Caliphate, for instance, and where they talk about the Moors in Spain, talking about very civilized people, very, just centuries of education and culture, and a culture that medieval thinkers revered, mm-hmm. right? Medieval thinkers were aware when they went to Muslim Spain just how far advanced they were as compared to them. That, the whole rise of the university owes its roots to Muslim Spain because they had the Greek corpus. They understood Aristotle and they understood logic and philosophy and medicine much better than the Westerners did. So what starts to shift, whereas medieval thinkers were much more aware of how elevated a civilization you have in these kingdoms of Islam, the Renaissance humanists start to willfully gloss over that. Mm-hmm. And they begin to create a connection between beliefs in Islam and ignorance. And it's not something that they wholly invent. I mean, this is something that some medieval thinkers had talked about, that there was this notion that Muhammad seduced the people, that he was a charlatan, and that he seduced this ignorant desert people into following him by promising them all kinds of earthly delights and what have you, that it was this sham religion. But you don't see a great deal of medieval thinkers trying to argue that contemporary Muslims were barbarians, that they were somehow culturally inferior. Yeah. That thought just didn't really take hold, I think, because they knew it was just absolutely ridiculous. But for Renaissance thinkers, I think because they convince themselves, falsely so, but they convince themselves that the Ottoman Turks are barbarians, they begin to extend that notion to all Muslims and to say that it is a religion grounded in ignorance. Therefore, these are people who are opposed to embracing the truth. They're opposed to critical dialogue. Mm-hmm. That they're opposed to the liberal arts. And that, I think, is something that might well transfer over to the modern colonial period and the modern age, where people still sometimes talk in very harsh terms about Muslims as being backward.
Well, you only have to watch Fox News, right?
Right, exactly, right. So, the sense that, that if you're a believer in this faith, you must be a backward thinker. And I sometimes think that, in some ways, this goes back to the Renaissance, this notion that Islam just gets this unfair attachment with a certain kind of lack of critical thought that persists for a lot of people.
So I often ask this question to guests on the show because, to some extent, our show is about the circulation of knowledge and the way people use libraries. Can you tell me something about how you go about doing your research for the book?
Well, I got the idea for this from a monograph written by Robert Black on Benedetto Accolti, who is one of the humanists who was writing about the Ottoman Turks in the 15th century and, in fact, wrote a history of the First Crusade. It's a wonderful book, and he spends a bit of his time in there presenting a huge list of other humanists who were writing about the Turks. So that was my first introduction to how widespread this idea was, that there was actually huge interest among the humanists in the Ottoman Turks in Crusade. And I thought it was fascinating because when you tend to think of Renaissance humanism, you tend to think of anything but that, right?
It seems counterintuitive.
Right. They don't seem like people who are interested in the East or interested in medieval concepts like Crusade and such. So that was my entree into it. How do I do my research? Actually, I'm able to find a lot in print because many of these humanists were writing at a time where shortly after they wrote, their works were printed. I have access to a lot of their letters, their orations, their opera. We have, for instance, the Opera Omnia of several important Renaissance humanists. And many of these were reproduced by Photostat in the 60s, which makes life easier for a lot of us scholars.
Yeah, great.
So. Right. So there's that. But I also spent a year living in Florence, where I worked on a regular basis with the Archivio di Stato, and I looked at some of the state records. I looked at the ways that the chancellors, for instance, talked about the fall of Otranto, and how they talked about major disasters taking place in the East, you know, major defeats, and when they're writing to these kings or they're writing to other states about crusade, you know, what language do they use? How do they describe it? I spent some time in some local libraries there, the De Cardiana, the Laurentiana, especially the Biblioteca Nazionale Centrale.
Those great libraries.
Yeah, they're wonderful, and the you know, the staff are wonderful, and you know, you're working in these just the Ricardiana is, it's this 15th century building, and it's just amazing to go and work there.
Yeah, Laurentiana is that's
the Laurentiana was I think Michelangelo designed at least part of that, and that goes back to the Medici family. Yeah. It's an annex off of the Church of San Lorenzo, so you know, you feel like you're kind of entering Medici territory when you go there. Mm. And it's a wonderful setting.
Yeah, it sounds great. So, last question.
Sure.
We started out talking about the place of history and historical study in contemporary culture. Is there enough historical content in undergraduate curricula, do you think?
Yes, the presentism question. Well, I'll take a bold stand on that. I think no. I'm very concerned as somebody who studies the past, and especially the more distant past, and I define that as history before 1800. I think some of my colleagues who teach the 19th century could make a similar complaint that I think that the curriculum around the nation and is starting to give way to this sense that if it didn't happen in the past 50 years, it's not important. Mm-hmm. That all the most important things that we live with today are in some way attributed to only recent events. And you know, I think that's absolute nonsense. I think that we're losing sense of where we are today, at the deep historical roots that brought us to where we are. So I think that it's precisely this problem that I think one of the mistakes the neocons make mm-hmm. is that they don't know about a lot of the rhetoric that they use coming out of the Renaissance, you know, and how false it is and how defensive it is, you know, and how creative it is, but not real. That, you know, the rhetoric takes on a reality of its own.
Yeah, sure. When you're talking about cultural destruction, that mm-hmm. the destruction that went on in Constantinople mm-hmm. in 1453 wasn't planned as cultural destruction, but by the time you get to the Serbian-Bosnian War, mm-hmm. it is conscious destruction, isn't it? And it seems to be something that's picked up from the rhetoric.
Yeah. So. I mean, I think if people knew their history better, they would go back and actually try to unpack some of these presumptions and say, okay, well, were the Ottomans really like this? And, you know, they would understand that it's a much more complex situation, the Ottoman rule in the Balkans and the relationships between people. You know, we're not just looking at oppressor and oppressed. You know, I mean, there's so much more going on that there's much more give and take. So I think, I think that on the one hand, a better understanding of the deep past, I think, would help people to think through problems in the present and issues in the present. I also just think from another point of view that the past is worth studying in and of itself, mm-hmm. right? Even if you're studying some aspect of the 12th century that has very little bearing on what we do today, it's still important to study to understand other cultures. You know, we talk about it in the history department as thinking of the past as a foreign culture. Mm-hmm. You know, that just as you want to know about other cultures around the world, it enlightens you, it enriches you to know more about the past. You know, I like to think of the example of Eric Auerbach when, you know, he fled Nazi Germany and went and lived in Istanbul. Mm-hmm. You know, for him, this was the perfect setting for him to do his research, but also continue to research and write on the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. You know, I mean, for him, this was still a very valid pursuit, that it's part of the human experience to understand the past. Yeah. And, you know, he didn't just throw it all away because of what was happening in World War II and say that it's insignificant. Yeah. You know, I think for him, if anything, the significance increased, you know, that it was part of understanding what we need to cherish as human beings and what brings us together.
Yeah, sure. So much of the scholarship, like his book Mimesis, that came out of that period, it had as its subtext the war, didn't it?
So, I mean, it's a perfect example of the past and the present meshing, you know, in a way that I would like to see more of. I mean, I think that the common phrase that I hear from students when they enter a class, I like to go around and ask them, you know, so why are you taking this class and tell us a little bit about yourself? And they often say, well, my whole exposure to the period before 1800 in high school was 1 year, you know, or it's sort of like 1 year in high school, maybe 1 year in junior high, as opposed to the emphasis that U.S. history gets, modern history gets. You know, I'm not saying these are unimportant, but it just seems like the focus on the distant past is getting more and more compressed.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a real danger in that. I think that that leads to these oversimplifications and just, it's a tremendous loss.
Certainly history provides perspective in mm-hmm. a sense that makes you see the horizon that you're standing on extend out in a way.
Right. That, you know, I agree. I mean, I think that the more people understand something like the fall of Rome, you know, or the fall of Constantinople, the more that they understand that it's not something that fits easily into a soundbite, it helps people to develop critical skills in thinking about the present.
Yeah.
Maybe if they knew more about the nuances of the distant past, they would be more inclined to look at things like the Iraq War or, you know, issues going on in Serbia today or, you know, Kosovo, and think a little bit more about, okay, you can't reduce it to one thing, you
yeah.
two things,
yeah.
you know, that this is a deeply complex yeah. issue.
So I want to thank you, Nancy, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe to talk about your book, Creating East and West, Renaissance Humanists and the Ottoman Turks, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press.
Thank you very much, Tom. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, it was great. It was a lot of fun.
Great.
So...